Welcome to Season 3 of Who Do We Think We Are? The podcast debunking taken for granted understandings of migration and citizenship in Britain today. In this season, we'll be considering the role of migration in the making of global Britain, as the UK redefines its borders and seeks to reposition itself on the world stage following Brexit. I'm Mikla Benson, a sociologist specialising in citizenship and migration, and your host. For this season, I'll also be joined by co-host Nando Sagona, whose research expertise includes international migration and forced displacement. Join us as we challenge public and political narratives of migration to and from Britain today, and encourage you to think differently about some of the most pressing issues of our times, charting a new understanding of Britain's migration story after Brexit.
So the big question is who the process of digital status is optimized for. On the one hand, you have the Home Office, the status controllers, or the body that issues and control immigration status ultimately. At the other hand, you have the status holder, so the person who is granted status and then has to evidence it in everyday situations. And then in between them, actually, you also have a big group of intermediaries, so people who have to control status in everyday interactions under the hostile environment policy. So these are two, at least, or actually three different group of stakeholders, and they will have different needs.
The point is that the system is becoming so remote and so complex that the people that are affected by it struggle really to understand it. So when you get you look at these campaigns that groups like Liberty or Privacy International run around pointing out about the risk associated with the digitalization, it really takes a degree in engineering to understand what they're talking about. And then you think this may have really an impact on the capacity of people to understand and mobilize for their rights.
Today, we're talking about digital bordering. You heard there from our guest, Kuba Jablonowski, who's a lecturer in sociology at the University of Bristol, as he asked, who are the stakeholders in the shift towards the increasing digitisation of borders and immigration status? You also heard from my co-host, Nando Sagona, on the challenges that this shift towards digitisation raises for advocacy around migrant rights. Before we hear more, let's bring this around to something that you might be more familiar with if you've travelled abroad in recent years. E-gates at airports and the advanced passenger information that you have to submit to your airline before you travel. Now, I'm old enough to remember a time when these weren't commonplace. But have you ever stopped to wonder what these technologies are for? Yes, it's true. It might speed up your passage through passport control if you can use these e-gates. But I always wonder what more is going on here. And what about for those people who can't use the e-gates? Since the UK left the EU, British passport holders can no longer use e-gates in EU airports as we did before. For me, this means that every time I arrive in Athens, my husband goes one way with his Greek passport while I stand in the queue waiting to be seen by a border guard. And that's just one example of how the technologies of the border sort between people on the basis of where they're from. But there is more going on here than meets the eye. The technologies of the border are also at work behind the scenes and in everyday life. In this episode, we're turning to consider these technologies and their use in immigration controls to reveal how, beyond the discourse of efficiency, these are intimately connected with the increasing securitisation of borders around the world. We consider why states have turned towards these and what this makes visible about bordering as a practice and a process today. And we'll consider what this means for migrant rights. Eleanor Zambelli explains what we mean by digital bordering, demonstrating how this is linked to surveillance and highlighting how this is one of the technologies through which an individual's right to cross borders is becoming increasingly uncertain. We'll hear more from Kuba about the digital and online only rollout of the EU settled status scheme. That's the post-Brexit status awarded to EU nationals resident in the UK. He explains the technological peculiarities of this status and how it's connected to the broader ambitions of the Home Office relating to the digitisation of the UK's borders. And he highlights how the needs of the government were prioritised over those of users, and the significant consequences this has had for people's experiences of being asked to demonstrate their status in everyday life. Finally, Nando and I turn our attention to how those taking part in our research experienced such statuses, how the online-only status further entrenches the precarity and insecurity among those whose lives and livelihoods depend on being able to demonstrate their immigration status, and how this links to the increasing atomization of the border. We also consider the challenges that this presents for migrant rights and advocacy, given the technological expertise required to understand and explain the issues with these new technologies. But first, it's over to Eleanor to hear more about what social scientists mean when they talk about digital bordering.
When traveling across the world, people are being subjected to multiple forms of tracking and profiling by state agencies. What risks are there for migrants and citizens in the growing use of technologies for migration governance and enforcement? Digital bordering is used to refer to how digital technologies are used to surveil, screen, filter, and manage people in their everyday lives. There are many ways to classify digital bordering technologies. One way of doing so is to distinguish them based on their visibility to the targets of their surveillance, us included. On the one hand, there are technologies which we may refer to as front stage. These are at least potentially visible to the person subject to them, who in many cases will be aware their movement and biometric information is being captured, even if this may be happening against their will. These technologies may be heat detectors, drones, fingerprinting, visual recognition cameras, and others. You may have, for example, encountered these at the border when crossing an e-gate with an electronic passport containing your biometric information. In some countries, such as the US, officials also have the right to demand access to a person's cell phone, tablet, and similar objects to seek evidence of potential immigration offenses or security risks in their digital communications. On the other hand, there are technologies which we may refer to as backstage, because they are inaccessible to lay people. Their remoteness is such that in some cases, we may not even know about their existence, where they are located, who's using them, and what for. These are, for example, systems used to process big data to profile the population and implement ad hoc measures to surveil individuals and groups deemed dangerous, undesirable, or for some reasons, subjects deserving special attention. These subjects are us, or anyway, just anybody going about their daily lives. For example, in 2019, it was revealed that the Dutch tax authorities had used a self-learning algorithm to identify people they suspected of childcare benefit fraud. These families were then penalized based on the system's risk indicators, with tragic consequences. An audit later showed that the tax authorities focused specifically on racially minoritized people, with some nationalities constituting a particular focus. You are right in thinking that this level and depth of control may feel quite personal, intrusive, and discriminatory. After all, the pros and cons of the ongoing process of border digitalization vary depending on who is assessing them. So, what's in it for states? Digital bordering practices are justified on the grounds that they are fast and cost-effective ways to collect and process data in ways that are both granular and macro, in depth and networked. On the one hand, everybody's data is constantly being collected and used to monitor individuals and construct risk profiles in different domains, from immigration to welfare to security and others. On the other hand, knowledge collected in each of these domains may be linked and cross-referenced with other databases, giving states access to a large and comprehensive pool of information supporting their functions. For lay people, however, these practices may look far less appealing, as they may infringe their privacy or even endanger the safety of their personal information in case of cyber attacks and data breaches. As Kuba Jablonowski will explain, they're also far from exact or infallible. And as decisions on who we are to the state we live in or travel to are already and may be more and more made by machines, this leaves us all with less certainty about our possibility to hold institutions accountable and seek remedy for discrimination, mistakes, and abuses.
That's a bit of an introduction to the theory, but let's turn now to look at an example and go into this in a little bit more depth. Here's Kuba explaining the EU settled status scheme and its relationship to the ongoing process of digitising the UK's borders.
The EU settlement scheme, which is the kind of the process, the procedure devised to transfer EU nationals living in the UK onto the UK immigration system after Brexit, it is indeed a digital-only scheme, or the status that the scheme grants is digital-only, but there is another important thing about it. It's also online-only, and that's probably the crucial bit. So the status holder, when they get status, they get no document or token that confirms that status. Every time they want to view it or evidence it to somebody else, they have to go to a dedicated website and then get authorized to display their status. And that's quite an important difference, because you can imagine digital-only immigration status that wouldn't work like that. So for example, you can think of a COVID pass or a boarding pass. We're all familiar with those. These are also digital-only documents confirming a certain status, but they do so in a different way. You can download them onto your device, you can print them, you can screenshot them, you can hold on to them. Whereas the digital-only status granted under the EU settlement scheme is nothing like it. It has to be generated through a website. And then if you want to show it to somebody, you have to give them a special code and your date of birth. And then they have to go to the dedicated website too, and then input all those details, input their own details, and only then they can view it. So that's an important difference. And then the other thing that is actually, you know, probably worth saying right at the start is that this system does not only apply to that cohort that the EU settlement scheme was designed for, because initially it did, but then it was extended to all other immigration routes. So as of April 2022, it's not only EU citizens settled in the UK that have to be using that system, it's all migrants pretty much. And the system will be extended by the end of 2024 to include everyone, all visa holders in the UK. That's the plan of the Home Office. The question then is, when a digital system like that is designed, whose needs are prioritized in that design process? And guess what? I think in the case of the UK implementation, it was the needs of the Home Office that got prioritized to start with. If we think of how the status works, the key thing is that it's not a thing, it's a process. As I said, there is no token of status, but rather the status is accessed only online, and it is computed in real time during checks from biographic, biometric, and immigration records. So the kind of what the Home Office calls the business logic, the engine of the digital status, has to resolve multiple identities and statuses, because for a lot of people, many statuses will be available on the records if they extended or changed the form of immigration leave they have, or if they apply to upgrade the form of immigration leave they have, they will have multiple statuses. So the kind of the algorithmic logics within the Home Office service will have to decide what to display for that person when they go on to check status. And then for another check, all this gets computed again. So you can never really be sure about the outcome of that status checks until you go on to generate status online. And in the course of my research, I saw people whose statuses were going terribly wrong between checks, sometimes getting entangled with statuses of other people without any action by them. So you can never be sure what the system will show when you log on. So that's a massive disadvantage to a status holder. You can imagine different alternative implementations of digital status that would benefit status holders, because, you know, it's probably wrong to say that digital status is good or bad. It's kind of, it can perform different functions depending on how it's done. So for example, if digital status resembled a boarding pass, then you could imagine a situation where you grab your passport as an EU citizen, go to EU country, you forget your residence card in a situation of physical documents. And then you want to go back. And suddenly you think, oh, how will I go back to the UK now that I don't have my residence card? And with digital status resembling a boarding pass, you can just generate another one and simply put it on your device, screenshot it, WhatsApp it, and you have it again. So digital status can have advantages for user as well, not only for the controller of status. But the way it has been implemented in the UK, it's quite hard to think about any particular advantages. So the digital border manifests in people's lives in the UK in very similar contexts in which the physical border manifested before, because we live under the hostile environment policy. Immigration status checks are parts of a part of everyday life, really. So people need to conduct digital checks. They used to be offline checks for right to work, right to rent, to access welfare, healthcare, and obviously at the border. But when we think about the border and crossing the border into the UK, we often think about border officials, but actually it is the border is also the check-in personnel at the airport. So the travel agent, it could be. So it's also those contexts in which people have to be able to prove that they're eligible to enter the UK. It doesn't only manifest for migrants. It obviously also manifests for those who have to check status. So if we talk about right to work, right to rent checks, it's also employers and landlords that have to carry out the checks. That raises important questions about quality assurance. How does the Home Office ensure that this is done in a non-discriminatory manner, for example? But then the kind of really final but very interesting point about digital checks is not when they manifest, but when they do not manifest. And when I was talking about that transactional design of digital status, where it's all conducted online, I think the main point of it is that it can be conducted, the check can be conducted without the consent or even knowledge of the person being checked. Because if it is all in the cloud, if it's all on Home Office servers, then there is nothing stopping a government department checking that that status. And that's happening already. Background checks are already implemented across a number of government departments. So status holders will not necessarily know that they're crossing a border when they cross it digitally. So if we accept that the digital border manifests in people's lives similarly but differently than the physical border before, then huge questions arise about equality's impact and discriminatory impacts of those borders and how they interact with things like gender, sexuality, and race in particular. Now, I will disappoint you here. The answer is that we don't know, and I think there is a need for much more research into this. But one example that I can give you is a report that we've done with Law Centers Network 2 years ago when we audited the client base that needed to use advice around the EU settlement scheme. It turned out that 44% of those clients were not white. And for A14 countries, so the old EU countries, you know, you think about Frenchmen, Germans, Spanish, Belgian, for that cohort, the proportion of black clients was almost 50%, as opposed to 40% of clients who were white. So there has been that massive disproportion that we found in the need for non-white applicants to get legal help with their EUSS applications. There is no race monitoring in the EU settlement scheme. The scheme itself is race blind, as are digital status services. So it's very hard to know, but there is quite a lot of anecdotal evidence suggesting that digitization disproportionately impacts people who are not white. The one perhaps hint at what may be going on is that those systems are built like an onion, right? So there are layers and layers and layers of data that they draw on. So EU settlement scheme, in the moment of application, it doesn't only generate data through the app that you use to apply, but it also draws in data from various government databases. So if there is bias in the data that the government collects, and we know that there is a lot of bias in the data that the government collects, and then if these data are used for decision-making, then possibly you get biased decisions. But that's the theory of it. I think to be able to successfully advocate in this space and successfully convince the government to do things differently, and if it is committed to digitization of borders, at least digitize them in a way that would be non-discriminatory, then we need to have more specific arguments about what's going on, and we simply don't quite know yet. Advocacy around borders and its evolution after Brexit is part of it is related to digitization, part of it is related to the extension of the hostel environment to incorporate a new large group of migrants or citizens. It's a very complex issue because from the outside, we think about migrants' rights campaigners. From the inside, when you get to know those campaigns, you'll see quite substantial political, ethical, methodological differences between different campaigns. And it's not necessarily a group of actors speaking with one voice. But it did change in quite specific ways since Brexit. First of all, you had new actors emerging. So the Thrumillion, the group that I collaborate with, is a prime example, but by far not the only. That's probably the organization that gets the most media attention. But there are multiple other organizations that emerged after Brexit or that gain new prominence after Brexit. Then you've got new issues coming up. So obviously the legal rights and the data rights of migrants became a new space for research, for advocacy and campaigning after Brexit. And that generated new alliances. So to give you one specific example of such new alliance or new form of campaigning, the UK government, when it was transposing GDPR regulation, the EU data protection regulation, to domestic law, they decided to insert a clause called the immigration exemption, where you couldn't get your immigration-related information if you submit a subject access request, so a request to data controller to give you your data. And it was something that was picked up by the Open Rights Group, which is a data rights campaign. And then the Thrumillion was also very much interested in that because of that digital nature of the EU settlement scheme. And they campaigned, they co-wrote a briefing for the European Parliament, but crucially, they also took the government to court and win, I think, twice now in a judicial review against this exemption, forcing the UK government to implement changes. Those changes are still quite contentious, but that had far-reaching consequences. For example, the EU inserted a sunset clause in its data adequacy decision. So because of that litigation, the EU says, we will share data with you electronically, but this adequacy decision may expire unless you sort out that immigration exemption. So there were new alliances and they actually could be successful in some ways. Talking about advocacy and campaigning around the digital-only immigration status, I would just say one key thing that obviously in order to engage in that campaigning, you have to make a call whether you accept that border controls in some form are legitimate or not. Because if you deny their legitimacy, then maybe it doesn't make sense to get entangled into questions how digital status should look like exactly. And you would say, for example, that people should be free to access services when they present themselves in front of those services without need for any checks, because if they're here, that means that they have the right to do it. So there are also quite important differences in how those movements that emerged after Brexit and that those movements that emerged under around data rights approach that issue for political reasons. I think in a way, you can probably keep arguing both, that everybody should have the right and also that everybody should have means to evidence the rights they have. But that's another conversation, I suppose.
You're listening to Who Do We Think We Are? Presents Global Britain, a podcast all about migration and citizenship in the UK after Brexit. Hosted by me, Mikola Benson, and my co-host, Nando Sagona. If you like what you've heard, follow and rate us on your preferred podcast platform. This means that you'll be the first to hear when our episodes drop, and it also helps more people to discover the podcast. I think that Cuba's thoughts on the technologies of digital bordering and that shift towards not only the digital but also online-only status, as well as his reflections on how these technologies are experienced and the glitches in the system, offer quite a lot for us to think with. And I just wanted to add a little bit more detail about this online-only status, because what Cuba was describing was how that's been rolled out via the EU settled status scheme. So that was the scheme for EU nationals who were living in the UK before Brexit to shift their status from that of mobile citizens to being people who were here protected by the withdrawal agreement. But it's also been rolled out for the Hong Kong BNO visa holders. And we've seen a little bit of organising around that issue between Hong Kongers in Britain. That's the leading advocacy group for Hong Kongers who've moved to the UK, and the 3 Million, who, again, that's the leading advocacy group for citizens' rights when it comes to EU nationals in the UK. But what's interesting, I think, is that this was not the case for the Ukrainians, who actually received biometric residence permits instead. So before we get into a little bit more detail around bordering and digitization, I just wondered, Nando, if you had any reflections on what those taking part in our research had to say about that online-only status.
A number of people we spoke to during our interviews pointed out how they felt uncertain about their own sort of the grounding of the right to stay in the country, because they didn't have anything to prove it. One of the people we spoke to, Leia from Hong Kong in her 20s, actually pointed out how if you are an old person which is not really used to live in the digital world, that uncertainty is even more marked.
Our generation may be very used to confirmation by email, but to older people, I need a piece of paper. Everyone is asking me, do you need a piece of paper passing the immigration? Did they issue you a piece of paper?
I think that quotation from Leia really shows the issue around what happens when you get to the border and the kinds of anxiety it might produce not to have a kind of physical proof of status when you show it, which I know is reflected in the case of lots of EU nationals who came to the UK. But it's not just at the border that that ability to prove your status might become significant. And Maria, who was Swedish in her 50s and living in the UK, illustrated this in her response to us about her experience of going through Brexit.
Because of Brexit, lack of physical proof, discrimination, etc., I was unemployed for a year in 2021. Before this, I have never been employed for longer than 3 to 4 months. I looked for 80 to 90 jobs per month. I have some debt now, so I cannot afford to move to the Republic of Ireland. I have to save money first.
What this really points to is this idea of everyday bordering, and we're going to discuss that a little bit more later on in our discussion. But I think to go back to this question of the broader context in which this is being introduced, I think it's important to highlight that EU nationals in the UK who were in the UK before Brexit were almost a test case for this new digitized system. There were a large group of people on whom that system could be almost beta tested. And this is one of the reasons why I think it's important to consider their case alongside other issues relating to migrants' rights. But there's a much bigger story to this, isn't there, Nando, going on behind the scenes?
What we're seeing is that the border is becoming diffused. It's become privatized by a number of people that are in charge to carry out border control. And in many ways, the border is no longer a point of where you enter the country or leave the country, so a geographical barrier. But it becomes something that you encounter in your everyday life. And this is where the concept of everyday bordering come from, particularly the work of sociologist Nira Yuval Davis. What is interesting, I mean, the example of Maria clearly pointed out, is this idea of, even if you have to apply for a job and you have the right to stay in the country, the uncertainty surrounding your status because you don't have any physical proof of your right to stay or you're uncertain can create in those who are there to give you the job, the employers, uncertainty. So they may prefer other people that can prove their status. We have seen it also with in relation to, for example, people trying to rent accommodation among the people we spoke to. And this has also emerged from research done carried out by other organizations, that some cases people are unable to prove, for example, that they have right to stay for a period which is longer than the minimum contract for rent. And so they refuse to renting the house. The point here is that if you privatize the control, it's also very difficult to guarantee some kind of consistency in the way that the rules are applied. You got a lot of actors engaging with this rule. Some people may be more cautious in the way they implement it, and others less. And this may cause very lot of difference. And also, as we know from a lot of research, if you happen to belong to a minorities or to a racialized group, you may find these borders much more on your face than if you are from sort of a majority group that normally is not affected by immigration controls.
So when we're talking about everyday bordering, you're also talking about what Colin Yeo, who was a guest on one of our previous episodes, refers to as the deputization of the border. So all sorts of people who aren't really official border officials or employed by the government being required to check people's right to work, right to healthcare, all sorts of other things. But if we could kind of step back a little bit, so some people would say, and certainly the government would argue, that this is just about making things more efficient. And obviously we see the fallout and it's experienced in the lives of migrants in very particular ways and in quite anxiety-inducing ways. But there's another story here, isn't there, about the relationship between bordering and what I think we could probably colloquially understand as surveillance. And I just wondered if you wanted to reflect on that a little bit.
So I remember in 2012 that David Cameron, at the time in which the government was launching its hostile environment policy against undocumented migrants, still invited people, the British public, to report online people that they thought they were undocumented migrants. And it was actually a move that really reminded me kind of Cold War tactics used by the Stasi or other intelligence agency, you know, to create this climate and this culture of suspicion and disbelief against migrants, which then we saw very much amplified in other aspects of society through the media, the politicians and other actors.
Yeah, I mean, I remember because I live part-time near the Kent coast, and all around the Kent coast from that period onwards, there would be these posters which asked people, you know, with this kind of quite Art Deco imageries, you know, to report anything suspicious if they see a boat that they don't, you know, that they don't understand why it's there, to report it immediately. So actually requesting members of the general public become surveillance agents for the state, reporting on their neighbours. But I think what's really important to highlight about this is that this is relatively new and that it does actually coincide with the hostile environment, that culture of disbelief. So the politics of migration are really fundamentally caught up within this, and indeed the politicization. And before we move on, Nando, I was just wondering about whether we should just break down briefly what that turn towards thinking about bordering opens up when we're discussing migration, as opposed to talking about borders.
In our research, we often point out to the fact that the politics of migration is not just about who enter the country through what pathways, but it's very much about the condition and the terms under which people come to live and work in these countries. I think one of the things that this idea of bordering helps us to see is it how a migrant is constructed as a migrant within our society through this continuous check on their right to stay, on the right to work, the right to rent accommodation, the fact that they can be questioned and asked to prove their right to stay by a number of agents, basically constructs the individuals as precarious, sort of embed in the experience of the migrant this idea of precarity, this idea of being very much a migrant worker there that is therefore working but not to create problems. So sometimes we talk about the creation of these docile bodies, which basically don't have the rights like other citizens, are people that are exploitable and can also be disposed when they are no longer needed. We have seen, for example, you know, a lot of the discussion around the migration often point out about the migrants that exploit the welfare system, the migrants that use our NHS, as if like life is not made also being unwell and having to go to an hospital. You know, you are good for us only as long and for as much as you are here for working. And I think this is becoming more and more embedded into the immigration system in UK.
Definitely. And we'll come back to this in a later episode about the stratification of those rights, I think, depending on which route you arrive in the UK. But to come back to this conversation around digitization, another side of this, though, is the kind of the important context of what the British government are trying to do. And very, very simply, they have this plan to fully digitize their borders. And I should stress, it's not just the UK who are doing this. And I'm obviously very skeptical about whether it's for the purposes of efficiency. But I suppose, you know, it's an easy narrative for people to pick up, the idea that it'll be way easier for me with my British passport to go through a border if the border is digitized. But What does that miss from view, do you think, particularly about that relationship between digitization and security?
I think obviously there is a couple of things, and I think Kuba pointed out this idea that there is on one end digitalization, and the other end there is also this online only element to it, which in the absence of a documentation with a term, an end date, you know, that this is the time I have the right to be here, it really sort of embeds the sense of precarities we just discussed earlier. So the point here is, in a sense, it creates this idea that your right to stay in the country is continuously reassessed at the time at which is asked. So it's not like that you have an expiration date, is that the expiration date is reproduced at the time in which the Home Office of the police inquired it. And so there is always the risk of the glitch that Kuba described so eloquently, but there is also this sense of feeling always precarious that has become the norm. I think that is a characteristic here. The other issue is that clearly, currently, this digitalization process is very much was introduced as an example of cost efficiency on one end, because the assumption is that it can be run with lower cost because it's digitalized, it doesn't need to have a paper trace, there is less people involved except in the decision making, etc. But it's also very much driven by a security agenda. And the thing which is striking and interesting is that while the UK was part of the European Union, it was very much a key actor, for example, in Europol. I mean, at the time in which we left the European Union, the director of Europol was a British civil servant, but also was behind the drive to digitalize and to exchange information. So there is one thing is about fingerprinting and using various technologies of monitoring movement. Another thing is basically the creation of this huge data set, this big data, and now it circulates between countries. So the point Brexit came, the UK has been cut out of some of these databases, and in a way, the security argument that was underpinning them has been strongly undermined by this decision. And in fact, we saw recently a part of the discussion which the Liberal Party is engaged with the European partner are around rejoining some forms of security community.
I think that that's a really important point about the interplay of Brexit with these discussions around what's happening to the British border. But it's also an important reminder that since the early 2000s, security has been part of the agenda around immigration control in ways that we might not have previously seen. So there's been this broader shift towards securitization, which happened to coincide with 9/11. But I suppose if we turn back again towards thinking about the people themselves who are subject to these forms of state power, because this is quite a significant source of state power. I mean, imagine this situation where on a day-to-day basis, a state can make a decision about your right to be there or your right to access particular services, just perhaps by, I'm probably being a little bit too conspiracy oriented here, but just by flicking a switch also and just deciding that day, oh, okay, no, actually there's too much information that's accumulated by this person that suggests that they're not well positioned in respect to the public good and therefore we're going to deny them rights. I'm probably getting a bit too 1984 there, but nevertheless, you could see how those fears could circulate.
Well, I don't think it really is a conspiracy. I mean, there has been a lot of cases in which, for example, application for naturalization have been rejected on the base of good characters. And the applicant really struggled to find out what was being raised as an issue of concern. And this is partly due to the fact that the databases are joined up and information are gathered from very different sources without knowledge of the applicant in a way.
Okay, so maybe I haven't gone too far then. So it's not a conspiracy. Yes, Big Brother is watching. But I suppose there is that other side of it, isn't there? Which is what this shift in terms of the technologies for controlling people trying to cross the borders mean for those who are subject to them beyond their individual experiences and into thinking about what it means for activism, for social movements, for migrants' rights more generally. Like, I mean, I've listened to Kuba present this work about the glitches in the system so many times, and I think I've more or less got the nub of it now. But it's so complicated and so difficult to understand. So I'm just thinking, even the people who are subject to this, to what extent do they understand what's happening beyond the injustices that are produced by it? And what does that mean for their rights to mobilize?
I think it is a very important issue. And I think it's a question that also the civil society organization and campaign groups have to face. The point is that the system is becoming so remote and so complex that the people that are affected by it struggle really to understand it. So when you get you look at these campaigns that groups like Liberty or Privacy International run around pointing out about the risk associated with the digitalization, it really takes a degree in engineering to understand what they're talking about. And so you think this may have really an impact on the capacity of people to understand and mobilize for their rights. So it's an issue that in the past, we have already seen it when the campaigning for migrant rights, rather than being run and driven by the migrants and the lay people, it became very much a matter for legal activists, not for the lawyers in court discussing in legalistic terms, bringing the case to the European Court of Human Rights, for example. And then the problem with this is that you may get some success, you may win some battles, but at the same time you are creating a distance between the public and issues raised, which affect both a distance with the migrants that are directly affected, but also I think it feeds into a narrative, which we have seen a lot by the right-wing government in place now, against the lawyers, against like the
rules experts
that come from outside. Yes.
Yeah.
And so there is an issue, I think, important issue to raise and discuss among the organizations about how to make it accessible, how to try to open up and creating alliances, not just with migrants organizations, but also with the broader public around these issues.
Yeah, I mean, it's a particular form of expertise, understanding the software and what's happening beyond that. But I think you're absolutely right. We really need to pay attention to what this means in respect to questions about activism around social movements, but also around migrant justice, I suppose, in consequence of those things. I think that's been a bit of a whirlwind tour of all things borders, bordering, digitization and migrant rights. But I hope it's given you a sense, as it has for me, about why we should care about some of these changes and why we need to look at those shifts as they're ongoing at the moment and pay attention and flag the injustices that they're producing. So thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Who Do We Think We Are presents Global Britain is a podcast produced and presented by me, Mikola Benson, and Nando Sigona as part of the research project Rebordering Britain and Britons After Brexit. That's funded by the Economic and Social Research Council via their Governance After Brexit initiative. And you can find out more about the project at migzen.net. That's migzen.net. A big thank you to our guest on this episode, Kuba Jablonowski, and to our voiceover artists, Eva Lee and Maria Chilimigres. A special thanks to Emma Halton at Brilliant Audio for her production and post-production support, to Eleanor Zambelli for the additional research, and to George Kalivis for the cover art and social media assets. If you head over to our newly updated website, whodowethinkweare.org, you'll find transcripts and enhanced show notes that include active listening questions, our podcast picks, and where you can go to find out more about the topics we discuss. And just a last call. If you're new to the podcast and like what you've heard, check out our back catalogue. We're into season 3, so there's plenty to dip into, from our deep dive into what free movement is and isn't with Elspeth Guild from earlier this year, to the consideration of European identities from the Aliens Act onwards with Balaji Balogun and Marius Turder. Get in touch with us via our socials to let us know what you've learned from listening and what you'd like to hear more of. That's all for now, but we'll be back with another episode very soon.